Good day, everyone.
Good day, Bruce. We'll give everyone a minute to join.
Sounds good.
Bruce, would you like to do the introductions or shall I?
If you would, please, that'd be great.
Okay, it's a minute after the hour, so let me get started. I'm Anne von Lehmann from the National Science Foundation, and I'm delighted to welcome our SCIES Distinguished Lecturer here today, Edward Knightley from Rice University. We in the NETS program here at NSF are long familiar with Edward's work, and we're especially happy to welcome him. He and his group have been doing foundational work in wireless communications, sensing, and security. And we're really looking forward to hearing how that work has been extended and leveraged in the Technology for All project. Edward is the Schaefer Lindsay Professor of Electrical and Computer Engineering and Computer Science at Rice. He is an ACM Fellow, an IEEE Fellow, a Sloan Fellow, and a recipient of the NSF Career Award, among many accomplishments in his distinguished career. So without further ado, I will turn it over to Edward. I would like to just remind everyone that the presentation will last about an hour. There will be 30 minutes for Q&A after. There is a Q&A function at the bottom of your screen, so please post your questions there, not in the chat, and we'll get to those at the end. So again, welcome, Edward, and go ahead. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Anne, for that introduction. And thanks to you, Anne, and the entire SCIES community for the invitation. It's a true honor to be giving this lecture today. And I'm delighted not only to give the presentation, but also for the office hours later. I'm looking forward to those discussions with the NSF team. In recognition of the occasion, I wanted to begin with some of the projects that SCIES has funded in the past, because not only have they impacted my own research, but the community, the wireless community, networking community at large. So I'm going to start going back to a project that started 20 years ago now, and it started with an NSF ITR grant, that's information technology research. And that program was targeting interdisciplinary, larger scale teams to develop bold new designs for the next internet, wireless and wired. And so we had a grant on what we called transit access points. And the idea was it's an access point that not only serves the clients around it, but also that can transit traffic in a mesh. And when this grant was awarded, it got announced in a front page story of the Houston Chronicle. And I got a call the next day from Will Reed, who's the founder of an organization called Technology for All. And he told me about his organization, and their mission was to, or is still, to empower under-resourced communities through technology. And he told me about how they had a refurbished PC program, as pictured in the lower left, where they were taking corporate PCs and putting new operating systems on them and getting them ready for the community. And then also how they had tech training. So it was the PC plus the training of all the technology tools. And what he told me is that the missing link for the community was broadband access. And that was out of reach financially for those in the community. And he asked me whether we would like to deploy our technology that we were developing as part of this NSF project you read about in that community and serve the actual users. So as you can imagine, the original goal was in-lab deployments and some in-lab experiments. And at that point, we didn't have the goal of doing an urban scale deployment, but we all rose to the challenge that Technology for All gave us and launched an urban scale deployment. And so once we had that goal, we developed custom software and hardware, transit access points, And so showing here in the lower left, these were some kids in the neighborhood that we employed to assemble and test the taps. And showing here an access node and some residents that we call them antenna hosts. And so what this antenna here would be and the node shown here was an access tier that provided access not only to this home itself, but all the neighbors around it in a couple blocks. And then this antenna also coordinates with other nodes that form a backhaul tier to interconnect them. And then we had some directional links that we called capacity injection links to scale up the capacity and provide the highest data rates possible. And so shown here, this is Will Reed, and this is a younger version of me. And then this is the one of the rooftop backhaul links there on the top of a tall building, so we could get a good connection to the fiber. And then you can see here that the entire network deployed, every red push pin is one of the nodes that we deployed in either a home or a building such as the YMCA there. So we became and still are the internet service provider for a high density, 1,000 users per square kilometer in one of Houston's most underserved and under-resourced neighborhoods. And it provided the first multi-tier urban mesh where it was access, backhaul, and also the capacity injection. And really a decade of PhD topics from my students and our collaborators, some about asymmetric topology and how some nodes, if we didn't take different action, could starve. Network architecture, how do you design this network? Where do the nodes go? Multi-hop congestion mechanisms, how do we make sure that the nodes closest to the gateway don't get all the bandwidth and we throttle them to the right level to make sure nodes farther away still can get access. Network measurement studies, network modeling studies. So it's research impact. And so you might think everyone's happy at this stage with the network and the deployment. And so now this is 2 years later in 2005. And there was a bill sponsored in the state of Texas that would have outlawed our network and every network that was not deployed by a quote licensed telecom operator. So you can guess who's behind the bill. It was one of the major cellular providers who I won't mention today, but at the time the model was every wireless byte should be charged to the cellular operators. And if you can get it through Wi-Fi, then that's a big threat. So this was a sponsored bill. It came very close to passing. Will Reed was the hero, pretty much camping out in Austin to try to talk to all the legislatures here. But so, you know, looking back, it is a disruptive industry shift that as Wi-Fi as a public internet entry point that beyond just the cellular network, that Wi-Fi can serve as an access point in public spaces. The mesh networking industry for multi-hopping is $5 billion industry today, and there's multi-hopping probably in your home. I have it in my home, and of course in many other areas, outdoors to indoors. In the standards, it was originally 802.11s, and now it's mandatory since Wi-Fi 5. These mechanisms I mentioned about making sure you can report congestion and throttle different nodes in the mesh to make sure that you get coverage in the more remote aspects. That was one of the important findings and made it to the standard. But lastly, the societal side about providing broadband for underserved communities. And what we heard from those in the community, like the antenna hosts that I mentioned, we would ask them about, you know, not just the technology, but what they were using it for. And they would tell us that it was transformative. Most for education for their kids, that was critical for them to have access, job search for them and their families, and really the notion of digital citizen where you have effective access to online resources and are able to use that. And that was something that was previously limited to those with higher incomes, and then providing that for all, you know, hence the wonderfully named organization Technology for All. And then I'll fast forward one more story from the past. And so this will fast forward 10 years. And this is the Houston Super Wi-Fi trial. And this started from one of the residents who was at very much at the cell edge. And she had, you know, that one bar of service and it wasn't highly reliable. It was really at a coverage gap. And she would regularly complain to us that the service was not what she needed to do the things that I mentioned for education for her kids and so on. And so we decided that we needed to use new spectrum, that we couldn't just keep deploying higher and higher density nodes, but we needed diverse spectrum to solve this problem. And so we wanted to use UHF TV bands. And so we got two grants in this domain, NSF, NETSI Large, it was called NETSI at the time, and MRI. And this led to the first residential super Wi-Fi trial. So super Wi-Fi, that's the name the tech press gave it. We don't know it, name our own projects super, but they called it super Wi-Fi. And the idea was to use unused UHF TV channels. So this is very much like, or is the concept behind white spaces and repurposing spectrum for use for other uses. And Wi-Fi is one possible use of that repurposed spectrum. And so this was the first time that this was done to a home, and we did a tower to home. And the research was in spectrum sharing. How can we coexist with TV? Diverse spectrum access. How can we fuse different bands from 500 megahertz up to 5 gigahertz? And also, I'd like to point out that there's some generational progress here, that this board here in the Super Wi-Fi trial was, and this is 10 years later, so it's multi-generations later from the original TAPS FPGA. And then the students designed a custom UHF front end. So this is the student Ryan Guerra who designed this custom front end. These are two of my students who deployed the antenna. They didn't tell me in advance that they rented a bucket truck, probably thinking that I would ask them about insurance and permissions and so on. So they just rented it and then sent me this picture afterwards. So they were very proactive, ambitious students to make this happen. And so success again. Now we're in not only the paper newspaper, but by now the tech press is catching on to these stories. It turned out that our first user, this is the one who had complained previously, and she's very happy now, as you can tell from the big smile with her super Wi-Fi service. And it turns out she's grandma. So the tagline that the press used was Houston grandmother is nation's first super Wi-Fi user. And so the press release is followed by some interesting post calls and post after the fact interactions. And so the next day after that tech press, I got a call from the FCC, and he told me that he had read the tech press about our super Wi-Fi trial. And he said, are you Edward Knightley, the one in charge of the project? And I said, yes. And I'm smiling on the other end of the phone, waiting for him to say congratulations. But actually, he said, do you have a license for that transmission? And so, you know, you can ask, okay, why? The answer was yes, first of all. But you know, the question, why get these questions right after this? And this was a tussle at the time between for spectrum sharing. The incumbents on the spectrum didn't want to share that spectrum. They were concerned about, would we properly use the right channel? Would we spill over and disturb? And so one of the things that was critical for us, but also the broader research community, was to demonstrate that, first of all, there's a value to shared and unlicensed spectrum, that we can be serving underserved communities, that we can have large population densities, and we can make great use of the spectrum, but also that we can do so without interfering with the incumbents. And so finally fast forwarding to today, the FCC, first of all, continues to open up spectrum, unlicensed and shared access, that we're making excellent progress with spectrum in the right direction. The spectrum sharing capabilities are now in Wi-Fi access points, for example. The 6 gigahertz bands for Wi-Fi have to coordinate with radar incumbents, and the mechanisms that are used are nearly carbon copies of what we had back in the UHF bands. And also in 5G, deployments and CBRS using diverse spectrum. And just to give a little story, this student right here is now CEO of Skylark Wireless that he co-founded. And so they're using diverse spectrum, 100 megahertz, that's UHF TV bands, all the way up to what we use with Wi-Fi, 6 gigahertz. And using massive MIMO to make sure, again, maybe these lessons from these from those frustrated with lower data rates, that we've got to cover the cell edges and get the high data rates and high bandwidth. So what I'd like to do now is transition moving forward and look at our current work and some goals for us and the community at large. And so what will the next generation wireless networks be and look like? And so some of the new capabilities that we can't do today in wireless, and that's these combinations of doing high data rates and terabit per second combined with low latency for new applications, but also to do it while maintaining mobility for the clients, robust to outages, security, which I won't talk about today, but that's another key component of wireless. And so one of the key drivers is to move up in spectrum, that everything I talked about before was in the 6 gigahertz and below. But if we start to get to millimeter wave and up to sub terahertz, in other words, 30 gigahertz up to say 300 gigahertz, then now our bandwidths become gigahertz versus megahertz. So a Wi-Fi channel is 20 megahertz, and if we Wi-Fi in 60 gigahertz is 2 gigahertz. So orders of magnitude, wider bandwidths, which mean order of magnitude, higher data rates. As we go to lower wavelength, millimeter instead of centimeter or tens of centimeters, solution for sensing also becomes increased resolution due to the lower wavelength. And we can now have high directive beams. I'll show you some beams that enable us to serve many users in space simultaneously, for example. And this can drive new applications. So just a couple examples, we can have drone networks. This is one of our projects at Rice about drone networks autonomously communicating and sensing. And so these drone networks can potentially have much higher data rates amongst each other, higher resolution sensing. And then other examples of, you know, virtual and augmented reality, that today, of course, there's wires. And if we had the high density that you're seeing there of users, there's no way we could not only provide the data rate to one, but the high density. So I wrote tens of gigabits per second per meter squared, the spatial density. So those are some of the things we can't do yet in wireless. And so I want to talk about some of the steps towards getting there. So get to the path of moving forward, I'd like to give a starting point of where we are with the standard and with the Wi-Fi standard, and talk a little bit briefly about how that standard works so you can see some of the challenges moving forward. So the latest standard for Wi-Fi in millimeter wave is 802.11ay, and it's at 60 gigahertz. And if you'd like to learn more about it, this is a tutorial overview paper by my former student and also two of the authors of the standard from Intel, as well as myself. And just to give a little sense of how Wi-Fi works, so at 60 gigahertz, it starts with an antenna array. So we have some number of antennas, and they do beam steering. And so how they beam steer is put some different delays or phase offsets, and we'll call them weights, for each of the antennas. So if all the weights are zero, then it just steers straight ahead. But if you want to steer to the right or to the left, then you put a phase gradient and you know, positive or negative phase delays on each of those weights. And so each of those steering directions are quantized and you call it a sector. And then there are up to 128 sectors per device. So now you can squeeze the beam width down to several degrees. And the standard has some mechanisms to adapt the select and adapt the sectors in order to steer. So how do you steer the beam? And then the latest standard also has MIMO. I won't talk about that today, but you can do this multiple times with multiple RF chains for MIMO. So how does the standard work? Just to give you a little sense of how to deal with directivity, because next generation networks will be highly directive, and so we've got to align the beams. And so this is the way that it's done in 802.11ay, and it's called a sector level sweep. And the idea is to transmit in each direction from, we'll start with the access point here, and then the client is listening in as best as it can in all directions. So it's called quasi-omnidirectional. So there's no truth such thing as omnidirectional. So it's doing its best to listen in all directions. And the sweep here transmits as many possible code books or beams as the AP has. And it does a short header in each of those to number the beams. So this is beam number 17 or something. And then there's also a preamble so that the receiver can actually decode the number and know which beam is the best. And then you repeat it in the other direction. So now the client is going to do its sweep and the AP is now trying to listen in all directions. And that yields the best sectors and the best beams in on both sides. So we've it's a successful method for aligning the beams, and so it works in Wi-Fi, and it's the best beam pair until there's, for example, a mobility-induced beam alignment. So we have here an AP transmitting to a couple clients, and then if the client rotates, then the client needs to re-steer. If the client translates, then both the AP and the client need to re-steer. So we're aligned, but we can lose the alignment with mobility. We can also lose the alignment with blockage. So if we have someone come in between the beam, then that is also blocked and we would need to re-steer. In this case, I'll show a wall that 60 gigahertz and higher frequencies can reflect, give it a specular reflection off of a wall, and so a flat surface. And so if there's a wall nearby, then we can re-steer the beam. Okay, now what's the problem in all this? Is this all solved and now we're ready for highly directional beam forming at millimeter wave and beyond? Well, one of the challenges is that that when it's blocked or when it's misaligned, while the training's happening, it's a temporary outage. And so there's no data happening when it's doing this sector sweep. So no data happening. This is fine if it takes a nanosecond, but how long is it taking? And so this is just to give you an example of the time scales. So this green data here is the maximum transmission time for data, millisecond time scale. And then this entire sector level sweep on both sides can be an order of magnitude more than that. So we'd like this to be the opposite. We'd like data to take this long and then the overhead to be this tiny little part in front of the data. That's what you'd love. And why is this? Well, we've got to have all the headers that I mentioned and we've got to test the different directions. So if we're frequently retraining, then the overhead can now start to dominate the airtime. And so when you get a wireless device and you see this data rate up to something, up to gigabit or hopefully in the future we'll say terabit, that's the physical layer rate. But if we spend so much time doing control plane and configuration and overhead, then the throughput can be much, much less. And the problem is going to get worse as the beams get more directive. So if our beam is this directive, then you can imagine the sweep taking much longer to try them all. And versus today's beams with a smaller number of antennas, and lower frequencies are more looking like this left one. So perhaps not as many different pairs to check. So the question I want to point you to is, can we rapidly re-steer the beams? And so to give you one of the designs that we've been working on, I want to first briefly review a new device above 100 gigahertz, or also I should say in millimeter wave to subterahertz. And the device is called a leaky wave antenna. And it gets the name from the construction here, which is two parallel plates. They're metal plates, and there's a slot on the side, and the wave leaks out the slide, hence the name leaky wave antenna. So if you put in an electromagnetic wave here, instead of just going straight through the plates, it's going to leak out. Now, the interesting property and the property that we'll use is that the angle that it leaks out, we'll call this phi, it is a function of the frequency. It's a very simple function. There's speed of light, there's the distance between the two plates, and there's the frequency. And so it's an easy calculation to say, well, if I put in a frequency, which angle does it come out? And that property is angular dispersion. And I said, you know, put new antenna in quotes because it's really from a design from 1940, and they noted the same property that I just told you. So new for us to be reusing it at higher frequencies, and I'll hopefully convince you that this is extremely valuable at higher frequencies. So one of the uses, and this predates our own work, but one of the uses was of a leaky wave antenna was for beam steering. So beam steering gets more and more challenging with phased arrays. You start to go to 300 gigahertz and above. And so this was the highest frequency beam steering mechanism to date. So to truly steer terahertz beams, they were using leaky wave antennas and utilizing this property that if you want to steer more towards broadside to the antenna, then simply lower the frequency. And then when you want to, raise the frequency, and then as you want to go more towards broadside here, then lower the frequency. And the remarkable thing about this design is its simplicity. It's one antenna beam steering. So normally, like I showed you with the Wi-Fi design, there's a phased array or this MIMO to do beam steering. But so we've got an ability to steer with the leaky wave antenna. And now the question is, where do we steer? Where is the client? So our idea was what we called a terahertz rainbow. And so the idea is that if we've got the angular dispersion property in a device, then we can take a high frequency pulse, which in essence we can view as containing all frequencies. So we're using a light analogy in this slide, where if we send in a pulse with all frequencies here, analogous to white light, then the leaky wave antenna separates it according to direction. The lowest frequency components are near broadside and the higher frequency components near parallel. And this emits in all directions. And then each direction has its own spectral signature. So in other words, this direction here is more towards the yellow component. So the receiver can identify its direction with respect to the transmitter based only on the frequency component. And so we call this one-shot location discovery because this only takes a nanosecond, this pulse. So remember, before we were in milliseconds, orders of magnitude slower to try to find the direction. And now we've got a single nanosecond pulse. And then all receivers, I'm showing one receiver here, but by knowing where you are on the rainbow, then you can immediately identify your direction with respect to the transmitter. So the remarkable thing about this is the things that it doesn't have. So it doesn't have the trial and error testing. It doesn't even have phase information. So there's no need to send a preamble. That was one of the problems with the prior methods is you first had to send all those preambles so you could start to use phase information with training and so on. And that's not needed here. And there's no array. It's again, a single antenna. How do we use this in practice? Well, Maxwell's equations can predict this peak emission angle curve given here, but it can also characterize how you fall off from the peak. So it's not that one frequency goes in exactly one direction, but one frequency has different intensities in different directions. So you can start to view, if I'm at 30 degrees as a receiver, then I'll see the peak frequency around 300 gigahertz, but I'll also see some fall off plus and minus about 100 gigahertz. So I'll get this entire signature in space depending on my angle. When we move this to an experimental component, then we have here our original theory predicted heat map, and then here is an experimental one. And so each angle now has its own spectral. And so the original theoretical one, or which is our antenna characteristics. And you can see again here, if I take 30 degrees as the same example, we've got the same peak around 300 gigahertz, and then we're falling off, but we've got some interesting other artifacts that a data-driven model could exploit. One is the model here only uses the first transverse electric wave mode, but here you can see these other 2, 3, and 4, which could be also used to enhance the signature. And also you can see how we get some spreading here at the very lowest angles that is not in the model, due to the model making ideal assumptions about the leaky wave antenna. For example, that the parallel plates are perfect conductors and infinitely thin and so on. So how does all this work? So we did some experiments, and this was my former PhD student, Yasemin Gassampour, and her thesis work. And the experiments show if we have a measured angle versus an estimated angle, and then ideally we want to be on the red line, that we've got this center region where we're just extreme high accuracy. And that's the sweet spot in these curves here. So that's as we're going here and we get a nice differentiation. And then we get a little more error as we start to go up sharp here and sharp here, where we start to deviate some from the ideal due to those curves being hard to differentiate at those points. So we're less than 5 degrees error in over 80% of the cases. And again, the key about all of this being in a single shot. One of the remarkable enhancements to this method that it wasn't by my own group, but I wanted to share it, was use of this method for radar. And so radar sweeps in all the directions, mechanically shown here or electronically, and gets a signal back. And to show an example of the rainbow used for radar, you can really imagine how this is going to happen. If you've got a rainbow type of transmission and then you reflect off of an object, then to know where the object is simply a matter of saying, well, which color did I get back? If I got back, you know, right on the edge of green and yellow, then obviously you're at this angle. And so this is Middleman's group at Brown University, and they called it a terahertz radar with a leaky wave antenna. And the remarkable thing about this experiment is the scale here. So the blue is where the object really was. It's a metal object that they're moving around, and the red is their estimate. And if you look at the scale, now we're here in millimeters. So they're able to tell you where this object is, millimeter scale, accuracy, a degree or so in angular accuracy. And again, with a single antenna, and they were able to do real-time computations and so on. So this is what I was alluding to with the fusion of communication and sensing. So with devices, the future devices, that it won't be decimeter scale inferences, but it will now get down to millimeter scale inferences. So really exciting times for the future of fusing communication and sensing. And my last point about leaky wave antennas is, if you're a skeptic thinking you'll never see two parallel plates sticking out of your iPhone, I will agree with that. And so one of our colleagues and collaborators, Kaushik Sengupta at Princeton, built a circuit to realize, he called it a terahertz prism. And this is only a year after the prior work on that, where he built a circuit to do 3D localization. And also, not only that, but we used 100 gigahertz up to 900 gigahertz. So we weren't being careful with how much spectrum he used, but in a real implementation, you'd have restrictions of the band. And so he used a smaller bandwidth, and it works over a smaller bandwidth. You don't need the whole 900 gigahertz to realize this function. So that's fascinating work. So the takeaway on this part of the talk and on sensing and communication is, you know, the old way of doing it was phased array, unique ID for each beam, that you've got to number all these beams, put a header on it, do trial and error testing with each header, and the scale of all this is microsecond. And if you want to know the location, then you do traditional array processing. With new devices like the leaky wave antenna and new physics, or really you can say it's old physics, but physics that's only now relevant, that actually angular dispersion is there at lower frequencies, but it's such a trivial effect that we don't even bother modeling it or mentioning it in papers. But now it's front and center with wide bandwidth. And so now with a single antenna, we can realize different spectral signatures, do all angles at once, and be done with localization in the nanosecond scale. And then also apply this, not just we were doing it for purposes of communication, but you can also do it for purposes of environmental sensing. And so I showed you the fast high resolution radar to illustrate that. Okay, so for the final part of the talk, I wanted to talk about a scenario, go back to this blockage scenario. So I gave you a scenario previously when I talked about beam steering and re-steering, and I said, well, there's an obstacle, but I made us get a little bit lucky in that scenario, and I said, there happens to be a wall right here, and so we're going to create a specular non-line of sight path over using that wall, right? So I gave us a lucky scenario. Now I wanna address the case of, suppose there's no wall, suppose we're blocked and we don't have a good non-line of sight path available. Is it game over? Is it just forget terabits per second and that's it? So the objective that I want to talk about today is, can we curve the beam around the obstacle? And you're probably thinking, no way, you know, laser beams, they don't curve, right? Flashlights, they don't give curved beams. So surely it's not possible to curve a beam. So let's ask the theoreticians. Let's see, can we do a curved beam? And will our friend over here, Maxwell, who's scowling at us, will he object and say that's going to violate my equations and therefore it won't propagate? Well, fortunately, a few decades ago, the theoretical physicist told us that there's a beam called an Airy beam, and I'll tell you why it got that name, that has a quadratic path. So we can have a curved beam. And moreover, it satisfies Maxwell's equations. It's a solution to Helmholtz equations. So it satisfies all of the key equations for the wave to propagate. And so the question that I'd like to turn to is, well, the wave exists, so in theory, so how could we generate one to curve around the obstacle? That's our goal, ultimate goal, curve around the obstacle. So the way it works is it's all about the launch of the wave. So we have to launch the wave with an initial spatial profile. And a spatial profile, I'll promise this will be the only equation I'll give. And this is, we'll call this 5x, and this is a spatial profile of the wave's launch at position x. So x here is just like antenna array or different points in space where you launch the wave. And so a profile means just simply what's the amplitude and phase of the wave you're launching. So think of it as launching many little mini waves, and each of these mini waves has a gain in phase given by this function. Now, if 5x was simple, and I'll show you a simple one in the next slide, then okay, we can understand what it's doing and why, But unfortunately, this profile is given an ARI function, hence the ARI beam's name. And this is a function you've probably never seen before. So I'll plot it. And this is it here in blue. So that's this blue function is a phi of x. So it's an ARI function with an exponential modulating it. And so this function goes up and down. It's oscillating. It's nonlinear. And then it peaks here. And then it goes down to zero on the right side. So the theory says if you initially launch a wave with this profile, then you get this on the right. So what is this? So this here, this is the same x-axis as this is, and the wave is propagating up. And so down here at z equals zero is where we launch the wave. So the heat here, the peak is the same as the peak here. So you see this is the highest here at z x a little less than one, and it's the most intense. The wave is most intense here, right there, because we put an amplitude of one there. Now, if we launch the wave there, what does it do? It starts curving in space. So it's curving in space. That's the red part is the highest intensity part of the wave. And there's nothing here. And then there's some interference pattern on that side. So the point is, if we can launch this, then we get this. That's what the theory tells us. All right, so let me give you a little context of these 5x functions. And so those of you who are doing wireless, it probably haven't seen the ARI function before, but you know about beamforming. So let me give you a quick beamforming. So what if you just wanted a beam and the no blockage, just steer the beam, blast in a certain direction? Well, what does the function phi x look like there? Well, then the amplitude on all antennas is constant. And the phase, remember those were the weights that I gave when I was describing 802.11ax. The weights, all they are different delays across the antennas. And so to steer a beam, all you do is a linear delay profile. And so if you have a linear phase profile, then you'll steer the beam. If this is zero, the beam goes straight. And if it's, and then you can just control the slope and that controls the direction that you steer to. So this is what we're doing today. We're doing line, line, right? And now we're saying ARI beam, let's replace this line with this blue function. And then let's replace the phase constant gradient with something that's going positive and negative. Okay, so how do we launch this wave? So I said at every point in X, we want to launch a wave with a particular profile. So if we're at this point in X, we want to transmit the maximum amplitude, no phase offset, because this is one, that's zero. And that's just a little to the left of the center. And then over here, for example, these are both zero, so transmit nothing over there. But we've got to discretize it and radiate waves. And so we want to radiate away from each of those points in space as many as we can. Now, suppose we said, use the antenna array. We already have an antenna array and Wi-Fi. Take those, whatever, eight antennas and approximate the ARI wave. Well, asking to do that is, in essence, asking to approximate this function with 8 points. And so you would probably think, well, with 8 points, that function will not be a good approximation. We need a much higher resolution approximation to this function to realize curvature. And so our approach is to use a metasurface. And a metasurface is a 2D structure. And it's got sub-wavelength meta atoms that are going to help us shape this this wave profile. So the amplitude and the phase of this profile. So let me show you how we did that. So first of all, the building block of a meta surface is a meta atom. So it's the radiating element. And if you like, just think of this as an antenna. Rather than a dipole, this is a circular structure that metallic and radiates. Now, this particular one is called a split ring resonator because it's a ring and it's got a split in it. And the parameters that are going to control the amplitude and phase and polarity are the three parameters I'm showing here. What's the radius of it? What's the opening angle? And what's the orientation angle? So what we're going to do is we're going to radiate these split ring resonators with a normal wave. We're just going to blast electromagnetic energy at these, but then we're going to rotate them in a particular way so that they radiate out with the amplitude, phase, and polarity that we want. So think about this as an atom by atom configuration. We're laying all this out to make all these atoms work together to give us this function phi x. So to put it all together, we're going to come back to our function in blue that is going to allow us to create the airy beam. And then for each point in space, we're going to select the meta atom that gives us the amplitude shown up here. So this is one, that's the highest amplitude, and that's a zero phase. And then here we want a lower amplitude down here, less than minus one, and also negative phase because it's negative. So notice this points down. So this one's pointing down, this one's pointing up. And then here, if it's horizontal, then the opening's horizontally aligned, then this is our attenuation. So just take these and line them up in columns. So this is our phi of x. So there's x, and then each column here is a discretization of x. So we basically took the function, discretized it, and put it on a meta surface. And now, wonderful, the question is, how do we build this? How do we radiate? Can we actually transmit in these bands? So there are two methods to fabricate these metasurfaces that I'd like to talk about. And I'm going to show you an experimental result using the one on the left. But I want to talk about two different classes of metasurfaces. So on the left, we have a hot stamped static metasurface. And this is this is developed by the Middleman lab that I mentioned before. And the idea there is to take a metasurface layout like this and print it on normal office laser printer paper. And then once you have that laser printer paper, to take that along with a metallic sheet, that's metallic powder. That's the same metallic sheets that you can buy in any craft store, and run that through a heating laminator. And at the output of the laminator, the metal will bond to the toner from the printout. And so this is a office supply printed metasurface that realizes the function that I just showed you. So we lay out an airy profile on this particular metasurface using this method. So it's rapid prototyping. We can do it in minutes. And it's inexpensive. Everything is just normal office supplies. So really simple to get metasurfaces. Now, the downside is once we print it, we can't change it. So if you wanted to say, well, now we're curving to the right, what if the obstacle moves and we need to curve to the left, right? Then you need to reconfigure the metasurface. And we obviously can't reconfigure something that's printed. So how do you reconfigure a metasurface? So this is a clever design by the Kaushik Sengupta's group in Princeton. And the idea here is to take a metallic ring and to short and open different segments of the ring. So here you wanted a ring and you wanted this part open. Here you want a ring with that part open. So how do you dynamically do that? You can't physically rotate the metal. So his idea was, well, we'll create dynamic opens and shorts, and that will enable us to emulate that we had rotated this in a dynamic way. Upcoming, we will have some programmable metasurface results, but for now, the first step is to show that we can do it with a static metasurface. So I wanted to show you one result along these lines. And so first of all, the setup. It's a small scale experiment. So the axis of the propagation distance here, these are centimeters instead of meters. Why is it so small? It's a limit of our in-lab method here. We have a sub-microwatt transmitter. So a real commercial system would be, you know, tens or hundreds of milliwatts for communication. This is a time domain spectroscopy transmitter. And so for spectroscopy, they're in the sub-microwatt regime. So we've got very low power, but nonetheless, we can do this at a smaller scale. And we've hot stamped a metasurface. It's transmissive. So we illuminate it with the pulse from the system. And then the metasurface is designed at 150 gigahertz. And then we measure the output of the beam after going through our metasurface. And so here, so again, this is the same X that we've been using the entire time with our function. So you have to view that the metasurface is right here. You know, this is Z where it's propagating. So the metasurface is at Z equals zero, spanning the X equal -3 to 5. And so the electromagnetic wave goes through the metasurface, and then this is what happens to it. It has a curve profile. So here's the heat map of it. So this is showing the strongest intensity point as a function of Z. And you can see this red line is the fitted trajectory. So we're fitting the maximum of the beam as it goes forward in space. So it's not just going off to the right. So if we were beam steering, then it would follow a straight trajectory like the right. So ideally, and this is work coming up, we'll be able to put an obstacle right there, and we'll be able to show you if you use a straight beam, doesn't matter how much power you give it, it's not going to blast through the object and it'll be blocked. And yet we will be able to curve around it and get energy up here. And of course, we'll get energy farther and farther as we put more power on this as well. It's also, you know, the theory was a great guide here. The theory told us we would be curving on this black curve and we're curving on this red curve. We thought it was a pretty good match because of some of the things that we're doing as approximations. First, we're always spatially sampling this function. Remember I said 8 antennas would be lousy. We've got many more, maybe 1,000 by 1,000 different meta atoms, but we're still sampling in space. And the meta atoms are imperfect because they're printed with a normal laser printer. The metal on the printer is just bonded metallic powder. It's you know, the theory assumes it's a perfect conductor and so on. But so we'll declare victory for the curvature and that can give us opportunity instead of the straight line of sight path. So future work, we'll call them airy networks. So we've, you know, generating a beam is a important first step and high fives all around the lab, but there's a lot more work to be done. First of all, at scale experiments, including the obstacles. So we've got to get real size transmissions to tens of meters, and then real size obstacles, people size obstacles, furniture size obstacles. And those experiments are coming up soon for us. On the control plane, you know, how do you aim the curveball? So, you know, I like the metaphor of the soccer player. And you know, if I can't kick like this, and so it just seems like magic, just like light bending seems like magic, or having a curved trajectory seems like magic, but it's all in the launch. So it's all what he does here. There's no manipulation afterwards, right? And think of our metasurface the same way. It was all about that 5x function. How do you launch the beam? And then after that launch, it's going to go where you programmed it to go. Now, that's a wonderful, powerful functionality. But you know, those of us in networking know that if you have a new functionality, you have to have a control plane to control that functionality. And so control plane questions are, you know, where is this target? You know, he's aiming for the upper corner of the net. Right, but he's blocked. You know, there's some blockers here. You know, he can maybe partially see where he's going. Maybe he can't even see it. Maybe he just kind of knows where it is. What's the best curvature profile and steering angle? That you know, do you want to try to curve way out as much as you can, or just go, you know, super close with less curvature? You curve left, curve right. Lots of possibilities. And then how do we program the metasurface to realize these functions? That once we get to programmable metasurface, we'll have a different set of imperfections. That it'll be a discretization, just like I talked about code books back in Wi-Fi. We'll have metasurface code books, and we'll have to do this within the constraints of the code book. And then data plane. You know, we've got to send information, right? The I in SICE is how do we get the information from the transmitter to the receiver? And I was showing results for, in essence, a single tone. So if we want to do high data rates, we have to use wider bandwidths. And so As we use wider bandwidths, the curvature will be a little bit different. And then how do we compensate for that? How do we analyze that? So the data plane part will also be a challenge moving forward. And I'm showing here a paper the three of us just wrote. It's on my webpage if you're interested. It doesn't have our experimental results yet, but some of the theory behind these types of beams and also others. So some of the upcoming challenges, just to wrap up, that I see in wireless, as we have new antenna and meta surface capabilities, this really changes the foundational building block. It's something radically new at the core of wireless. And so once that basic building block changes, everything else above it changes as well. So how should the network be designed and architected? What does the network look like in its layout? Optimization and management. So how do we dynamically, we don't always want to curve a beam. So when do we even invoke those features to curve beams, and how do we know what the right criteria is? A second thing I'd like to talk about is, I ended the talk with these higher frequencies, but we'll still always be using the lower frequencies. And so those lower frequencies give us coverage and penetration that we just can't get with the higher frequencies, which give us these wonderful data rates and sensing. So future networks will fuse all of these. It won't be a choice one or the other. We will use them together. And so that gives a new opportunity for network architectures, network design, analysis of sensing. It's this wide a spectrum is just unprecedented. We've never had it that wide. Think about Wi-Fi. We have 2.4 or 5 gigahertz. We get a factor of 2, right? Here we're talking about several orders of magnitude. I mean, it's just astounding the diversity of the spectrum that we'll have moving forward. The components. So our circuits colleagues are system designers giving us programmable, low-cost, energy-efficient components. That has to happen in parallel to have the next-generation devices. And then lastly, two points that I didn't bring out in the discussion today, but I think are really important moving forward, and I want to bring it out explicitly. One is how powerful the physical models are at higher frequencies. That is, it's not the physical models don't work at lower frequencies, but there's so much scattering and reflection off of every device that it, going back to, say, a model of a wave is just not helpful. Versus here, you saw with the leaky wave antenna and you saw with the airy beam that the physical model, I mean, this is straight out of, you know, Maxwell's equation, that those are providing tremendous guidance. And so that guidance helps us not only as designers, but I think it will help us in the field as well, that when we go to sensing and learning and trying to understand the environment, rather than be pure black box, that we can use the physical models to help with those inferences. And lastly, new applications and use cases. So as we get to higher and higher data rates, that working with real scenarios, real devices, just like I talked about with Technology for All in the beginning, that taking technology to the ultimate end users is super valuable feedback, because it helps optimize what's really important to some of those users. And that can also foster the next generation of designs. So to summarize, we started with Technology for All and the tower and the diverse spectrum and multi-hopping, and then got to the one-shot path discovery and the terahertz rainbow. And then I ended up showing you how we could take a meta surface, put an airy profile on it, and then generate a beam that curves in space. So I'll end by acknowledging my PhD students and alumni at this talk. Since I went back 20 years, it's got an excellent group of former students and current students as well, who helped with the work I showed that's ongoing, but all of them are on my group page. And then collaborators at Rice and beyond, I mentioned papers and work from Dan Middleman, Joseph Jornet, and Kaushik Sengupta. So the papers that I cited from them are on their respective sites. sponsors. The Army is funding some of our work in security, which I didn't mention today, as well as some of the work in sub-terahertz. Cisco and Intel have been longtime sponsors as well, and they've been a great input of not only understanding where standards in the industry are going, but giving a chance for us, the community, to influence where they're going. And then lastly, and of course, most importantly, National Science Foundation. And so I again acknowledge and thank you all, not only for the invitation today and the chance to talk to you all, but also for the support that's just every slide on this presentation has had NSF support in it. So I thank you all for that. And with that, I will conclude, and I'll be very happy to take questions and comments.
Thank you, Edward, for a wonderful talk and demonstrating that you can bend light at least at the right frequencies. So the floor is open for questions and answers. Just a reminder to folks, we welcome all questions, and you can just put your questions in the Q&A, and we can go from there. And while we're waiting, Edward, let me just start with at least one. On the description of the metasurfaces and using them as reflectors or ways to get around a blockage in the beam, how do you see that scaling? Are there difficulties there? You talked about, like, what if I have to get around a piece of furniture or, you know, a car or something? You know, my beam is blocked by a larger object. How do you see that working?
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's great question, and I would say it's a research question for us. I mean, on the math side, the math scales. So that there's not, we won't be breaking part of the beam as we try to bend more and more. Some of the things that are needed, if you wanted a really wide curvature, for example, is one of the physical limits is this, this ultimate width here, right? So, we're showing, 8 centimeters. So if you want to keep bending and bending, then you've got to get larger width. So if there's a scenario such as, a car where you wanted to, get radar, or different sensors, bending around objects, then you could potentially use the larger surface of the car to do things like that. But if you've got a small device, then eventually you're going to be limited by this aperture here as for how much bending you can have. But for sure, that's one of the challenges moving forward, is to explore how we can overcome those practical limits of transmit power budget and then aperture size of the transmitter.
Yeah, thank you. We have another question. What is the decay rate or power loss of the parabolic wave?
Yeah, great question. And we had a meeting about that yesterday, where we were looking to do that calculation, because you can't just plug in the Friis equation and say, well, here's D, so we'll just do the path loss. But it is computable. So we have not done that yet, but that is something that is very important, and we will do, and we're hoping it'll come to some nice closed form result where we're able to start using it, say, in a link budget analysis, just the same way we would regularly use like a Friis equation. Say I lost a few dB here due to an object, and a few dB here due to the receiver, and so on. And that here we could say, okay, if my total distance over the parabola is this, then I can do the calculation. And so we will for sure be giving some good analysis of that coming up.
Yeah, thanks. Next question. The overhead using traditional phased arrays is large, which is eliminated in using leaky wave antennas. What about the data rate using a single leaky wave antenna?
Yeah, so the leaky wave antenna, maybe if I go back here, yeah. So we didn't for our leaky wave antenna, we didn't send data over it, it. So we were doing the direction finding and didn't send data. So one of the key things would be the efficiency of coupling into the leaky wave antenna for us, and then the total power. So as I mentioned, our total power is very low microwatt scale. And the efficiency of coupling into and out of the parallel plates was something we didn't optimize because it was more of a direction finding thing than a data thing. But there are others who are using leaky wave antennas for data. And then that becomes front and center for them. You've got to couple in efficiently and you've got to emit at tens of milliwatt scales, if not 100 milliwatts, you know, rather than what we were doing with microwatt. So I'll leave that to the CMOS implementations. This particular paper was about localization, but I believe that there's some other papers here showing the use of it for data. And so they are able to get directivity gains, although I don't have a specific number for you today, but for sure there's a possibility of getting the high directivity gains that we like phase arrays for, even with the leaky wave antenna.
Okay, thank you. Over what distances might the leaky wave antenna technology work?
Yeah, so this is not a restricted distances in any more severe way than any other antenna. So once you get the beam forming gain, you know, now you actually can do a normal link budget analysis. So once you select your frequency band, then that frequency is going to propagate in that direction. Yeah, with path loss according to the Friis equation. So from that, you're not going to be distance constrained by the leaky wave antenna. In fact, one of the let's see if I can find the original patent here. This guy. So they were originally using this for aircraft. So they wanted to point it up and see what the relative angle was of the aircraft, and you could analyze the signal based on that. So this was being used for long distances, air to ground. So these are definitely able to realize the beam forming gains that you're accustomed to with traditional methods like phased array.
Okay, yeah, makes sense. One more question in kind of a high level question, I guess, is we hear a lot about 6G. And so do these technologies and ideas play into the next generation, and how, and maybe when?
Yeah, so for sure. I mean, I think 6G, Wi-Fi 8, you know, I think these will be where you'll see frequencies, 60 gigahertz, 100 gigahertz beyond taking off. And one of the wonderful things too about standards, especially Wi-Fi that I know the best, but is that they leave so many aspects of it that the vendors can do on their own. In other words, all the vendors are allowed to innovate on top of the standards. So they leave it flexible enough. And so what you can end up with is a standard that, even if it has a sector sweep, that devices can still add on additional methods in order to do that process better. So let me give a specific example. The standard doesn't tell you what type of antenna to use. You can use a leaky wave antenna. You can use you can switch among sector antennas. You could use a phased array and so on. So none of that is prescribed in the standard. So you can potentially do things on top of the standard, and use it as a vendor specific enhancement to the standard. But broadly, the higher frequencies are very much a part of 6G. And that is because of the data rates. It's really my first slide as I move to moving forward. The data rates, the wide bandwidths, and the sensing resolution, joint sensing and communication, those are all 6G and Wi-Fi 8 sort of technologies that we want. So utilizing. So when we get to those frequencies and that directivity, then we're very much going to want different methods for fast localization and, you know, curving beams and so on. So absolutely the context of this, I would say, is very much 6G.
Okay, thank you. That's kind of the end of our questions for now. In the Q&A, we also got many thumbs up and thank yous for the presentation. So again, thank you so much. As we've seen, the presentation has been recorded and will be available. So if you missed some or all of it, you'll be able to replay it. And just a reminder for NSF that there is an office hours this afternoon at 3:30. And so bring further questions and discussions there. So I think with that, we will conclude this seminar. And thank you again, Edward, for a wonderful presentation.
Okay. Thank you, Anne. And thanks to all the audience.